Taking Stock with Pim Fox.
My guest right now, Jim Sterngold of Bloomberg News. And Jim, I want to bring your attention to a story today having to do with Japan. Tokyo Steel Manufacturing, Fuji Heavy Industries. These are the big producers in Japan. They're going to have to deal with a 15% energy cut this summer because of power constraints in the country. They're going to have to move some of their production to plants in the western portion of Japan. Are we too complacent about Japan's ability to rebuild quickly? Because there was a big story, I think, in the New York Times today detailing that there are certain products, certain types of high-tech industry essentials, 90% of which are made in Japan. And with those factories knocked out or at least on curtailed service, that could mean a disruption in global supply chains.
Well, there already has been a disruption, as we know, looking at some car manufacturers in this country that rely on components produced in Japan. You know, the key word that you used in that statement then, Pim, was quickly. Are they going to produce it quickly in terms of how long it takes to produce a major manufacturing plant? Yes. Are they going to produce it, be able to fill these gaps quickly in terms of prevent these slowdowns in car manufacturing and whatnot? I'm guessing not. I think that these are big long-term problems. Japan always does a fantastic job in planning and satisfying these long-term needs, and they might be able to do it quickly, in air quotes, but that could mean a year or two. I'm guessing there are going to be disruptions for a while.
Let's bring in another watcher of what's happening in Japan. We got Clyde Prestowich of Economic Strategy Institute. He is also former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce. Clyde Prestowich, great to have you with us here on Bloomberg. You think Japan can get its act together fast enough to supply the supply chain we all depend on?
I think it's going to be a mixed bag. I mean, the Japanese, tend to overperform in these kinds of situations, and they'll certainly turn themselves inside out to minimize disruptions in the supply chain.
But all right, we've got more with Clyde Prestowich, more with Jim Sterngold. The Japanese national anthem. I'm surprised I have not heard that more recently, given the crisis in Japan. We're talking about what's happening to Japan and its effect on the global supply chain. My guests are Jim Sterngold of Bloomberg News and Clyde Prestowich of Economic Strategy Institute. He is also the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce. Jim Sterngold, does this situation highlight how dependent we have become on this just-in-time inventory system, that all of this great technology, all of the great global communications, the world is flat concept, really kind of comes a little bit unstuck in a situation like this, where if you're only carrying a couple days or maybe even a week's worth of supply of products, boy, that modern world stuff, that could come back and bite you in a very difficult problem.
It absolutely can, and do consider the irony that it was Japan that perfected the just-in-time system, and they were justly celebrated in books as Japan is number one and all that, because they had this incredibly fine-tuned system where they didn't waste money on inventory and warehouses and stuff like that. Yes, we are incredibly dependent on these things. Japan will figure out how to respond, and they will respond fairly quickly. But again, the emphasis is on fairly quickly. It could take certainly months or a while for them to plug these substantial gaps.
Clyde Prestowich, come in on this topic of the supply chain and this idea of just-in-time ordering. I mean, it sounds like a great idea, except when you bring in these events that no one can really foretell.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, the old idea that you keep a few stocks lying around just in case looks better when you get hit with something like this. But I think there's another factor here. It's not just the just-in-time system, but it's the fact that there's only a few suppliers. I mean, you know, if we had another producer of silicon wafers, for example, in the U.S., who was also supplying just on time, this wouldn't be such a big hit. But a large part of why this is a hit is because the U.S. has essentially given away its industrial base And so it's a combination of just in time, and the guys who do it just in time are there's only one or two of them, and they're in the wrong place.
Well, Clyde, is it possible that this will spur some changes to not only the corporate policies of American companies, but perhaps even to the policies of the U.S. government? I mean, why should we end up being dependent? We always talk about oil as this great addiction, foreign and imported oil as a great addiction for the American economy. Why doesn't the government focus more on our dependence on these essential items of production?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's a complicated answer, but I hope that this situation is that will spur a bit of a rethink, because whereas in the case of oil, you kind of have to take it where it is. It just happens to be in the wrong place. But in the case of silicon wafers, it's really just a matter of investment in technology, and those skills are obtainable in the U.S. You just need the policies necessary to encourage the investment. The problem is that we've seen an erosion of those skills in the U.S., but there's no reason why they can't be revived. And so I hope that this will spur a rethink both corporately and in the top reaches of the government.
You know, this is a good point. I'll add very quickly that it has been both the policy of many of our biggest companies and the government as well that, look, we can outsource this stuff, because what we do, what really adds value, is we design the products, we invent the products, we have all the brains, we have all the patents, and there's so little value added by the plant that actually fabricates these things. It's just as well that they emigrate to Taiwan or Japan or China or something like that. Now we're finding out what that dependence can mean.
Well, I want to bring up an article in this week's edition of Bloomberg Businessweek. It's in the enterprise section, and I love the title of it. It's called Suddenly, Made in the USA Looks Like a Strategy. And this has to do not necessarily with Japan, gentlemen. This has to do with the apparel industry and how so many of the factories that we depend on in China for the manufacture of apparel will not take small or mid-sized orders. So those orders are now being filled by companies such as Boathouse Sports. That's a manufacturer based in Philadelphia, and they have worked to get their costs down. They're still about 10 to maybe 15% higher than the costs in China, but the companies that are looking, in this case, it's Dartmouth College, they're looking to get their apparel made. And it turns out that they're willing to add that 10 or 15% because they can control costs. They can also control quality, Jim Sterngold.
No, absolutely. It's funny. When I was living in Los Angeles, one of the surprises to many people there was that they still have a fairly large textile industry. And it does exactly what you're describing, which is small orders. If you want to order 1 million shirts, you go to China or some country in Asia. If you need 10,000 shirts because you're quickly trying to fill out a product line or something, you keep that in the U.S. But this is an area that's been underfunded for a long time.
All right, we've got much more with Jim Sterngold, Bloomberg News, and Clyde Prestowich. This is Taking Stock. All right, a little bit of Japanese music there to keep us in the mood. We're speaking about Japan and its role in the global supply chain. My guests are Jim Sterngold of Bloomberg News and Clyde Prestowich. He is the chief economist of Economic Strategy Institute, formerly a deputy assistant secretary of commerce. He's also worked for Scott Paper, and he's directed operations in Europe, Asia, and Latin America for the American Can Company. Clyde Prestowich, what is the reputation of American-made products overseas?
Lousy. It used to be a joke. We'd be negotiating with the Japanese and complaining that their market wasn't open, and they would say, "What are you talking about? You know, your service is non-existent, your quality stinks, and your delivery is always late."
Is that still the case?
Well, unfortunately, too often it is. I mean, I think things have improved since that time, but the reputation of the U.S. Is not great. For U.S. made products, that's a little bit different thing. If you're talking about an American company producing something, I mean, like GM producing cars in China, I think they have a good reputation. But stuff coming from the U.S. does not have a good reputation.
That makes it really difficult, doesn't it, Jim Sterngold? I mean, that's stating the obvious, but boy, if that's the situation right now, then it seems almost impossible for American companies to extend their product lines and build out their presence in overseas markets.
Well, I'm going to agree and disagree with Clyde at the same time, because on the one hand, Clyde is right. There is, or had been, certainly for a while, poor performance by American companies in Japan in particular, because they didn't think they needed to put any time into it. The irony here, of course, is that American stars were sought after eagerly. You can't believe how many American stars and old stars were doing silly Japanese commercials to sell scotch or sell coffee or sell ham. Arnold Schwarzenegger sold ham.
Arnold Schwarzenegger sold ham
and,
on billboards.
And Sylvester Stallone sold ham.
In Japan.
In Japan.
So they love American Hollywood, but they don't necessarily like American
products.
So
they love the American image is the point. Yeah. And things that seem to represent the essence of America, but the products they didn't like. Where I disagree with Clyde is this idea was often used as an excuse by the Japanese government. There were occasions when American products simply didn't have access, and the government would say, well, if the Japanese people thought they were good quality, they'd buy them anyway, but they don't buy them. So I think there were cases where that's correct, but some cases where they were just blocked out of the market and didn't have an opportunity to try to compete.
Clyde, what do you think about
that? I agree with Jim on that. In fact, we had a famous case where Japanese argued that American skis could not be used in Japan.
Oh, on Japanese snow.
Snow is different than American snow.
You're kidding.
It was a famous case.
You mean that the Japanese, like real Japanese trade officials, claimed that the snow in Japan was different enough to make it impossible?
Oh, yeah, it was Japanese snow, totally different. You couldn't use American skis on that. Everybody would fall down and run into trees.
I'm laughing because I do remember this. Clyde is exactly right. The argument was...
And that would be like in a serious trade negotiation conversation,
yes,
amongst people.
Yes,
like,
yes.
And I'm just curious, Clyde, like what happens when you hear that? I mean, do you ask for the translation again?
Well, first you ask for the translation again, and then it comes back, and you don't know whether to laugh or cry.
It's different snow. Jim Sterngold, I mean, is that kind of what we're still up against? I mean, because, boy, if it is, I mean...
I would say culturally, you know, the world has changed somewhat, not as much as we would like, but somewhat. And you know, it's not just Japan anymore, of course. We fight with China every day over one product or another. And, you know, there's always some kind of claim of, you know, sucking of teeth. You know, our country, our culture is not really compatible. That doesn't really work
right
for us.
Our rice is different than your rice, and we don't want to import or sell your rice.
Well, it was a major crisis in Japan, right, when they had an agricultural crisis, and they didn't produce enough rice, and they had to start importing. And you would have thought that, the country was being infected with some kind of terrible foreign virus.
But instead, we just tried to get our skis in, and they wouldn't let us do it.
It's the snow.
Clyde?
It's the snow.
Clyde, what do you think? Is that still going on?
Well, I agree with Jim. Things have changed a lot, but those, you know, some of those attitudes linger. It's a lot easier now than it was 20 years ago, but you run into this kind of attitude still. And not just in Japan, but in many, many places in Asia.
All right, we're going to continue the conversation with Clyde Prestowitz. He is the president of Economic Strategy Institute. Also more with Jim Sterngold of Bloomberg News.
Could you do it slower?
最高な気持ちで。
More intensity.
Suntory time.
本番。本番。本番。用意!
Stop!
For relaxing times, make it Suntory time.
Yes, from the movie Lost in Translation by Sofia Coppola. Lost in Translation, the U.S., Japan, and its export economy. My guests are Clyde Prestowitz. He is the president of Economic Strategy Institute. He's also the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce. Also with me, Jim Sterngold of Bloomberg News. Clyde, a listener from New Jersey, Matt, he wants to know, What are your thoughts about the competitive advantages of companies such as United Technologies' Otis Elevator Division, of course, Apple, Amazon.com, Caterpillar Earth Moving Equipment, you've got farm equipment made by John Deere. I mean, aren't these still considered the standard against which many of the domestic producers are still measured?
Yeah, many of them are. Many of them are, as you know, world-class companies. They make world-class products, and they do well in world markets. But even many of those, some of those companies you named, have had great difficulty getting into the Japanese market.
But and is that, is that as much a political issue as it is an economic one?
I think it's partly political, but I think it's structural. I mean, in other words, in order to sell equipment, heavy equipment, you often need to have a dealer or a servicing capability in the market where you're selling, let's say in Japan. And in Japan, it has often proven very difficult to get that kind of dealer or representation or service capability. Because the dealers are all kind of controlled by your Japanese competitors. Japan, most countries in Asia don't really understand antitrust. They don't believe in it. So there's no such thing as, you know, competition policy, or you can't go to court and complain about price fixing or antitrust violations. And so it's often much more difficult. I mean, you know, we're talking about Japan, but we have a free trade agreement with Korea currently being considered by the Congress. And on the face of it, the free trade agreement looks pretty good. The Koreans are going to reduce their tariffs on things like autos to zero, and that looks pretty good. But what you have to understand is that to sell cars, you need a dealer. And getting a dealer in Korea for an American company is going to be very, very difficult.
Jim Sterngold, come in on this topic. I mean, is it possible that much has not changed, at least when you look at the relationship between the United States and Japan from the 1980s, when we talked almost nonstop about the closed nature of the Japanese economy?
Look, all economies, including the American economy, have blind spots. There are things that we want to protect, and sometimes it's for blatant political reasons in the worst sense of the word. It means that there are some representatives in the Congress or the Parliament who are beholden to local interests, and they will protect those interests by preventing imports. So, political issue.
We've got more with Jim Sterngold, Bloomberg News, more with Clyde Prestowich, Economic Strategy Institute. Some Japanese music there to keep us focused on our topic having to do with Japan, the global supply chain, and the ability of U.S. companies to compete in domestic markets around the world. My guests are Jim Sterngold of Bloomberg News, Clyde Prestowich of Economic Strategy Institute. He is also the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce. Clyde Prestowich, have American companies given away technology in order to get short-term benefits? And I'm thinking here of, for example, companies such as Boeing. They outsource a lot of the manufacture of the new 787 Dreamliner to companies in Japan. Is that going to, in future years, look like a foolish decision?
I think it will, but I think that I think there are two categories. There's one category where companies, corporate executives, just make kind of foolish short-term decisions. A good example would be videotape recording. Ampex was the inventor in the U.S. of videotape recording, and they pretty much just voluntarily gave the technology to Toshiba and others in Japan in return for some cheap manufacturing in the 1970s. I think Boeing's in a different situation. Virtually every major government in the world, every major economy in the world wants to have an aerospace manufacturing sector. They see it as strategic. They see it as stimulating technology. They see it as producing high-value, high-wage jobs. And so to get that, countries will say to Boeing, look, you want to buy from us, or we want us to buy from you, you need to do some production here. Japanese airlines, Japan Airlines and ANA, are both, I think, almost entirely Boeing. I don't think they fly anything except Boeing planes. Well, there's a quid pro quo, and the quid pro quo is Boeing has to put production and transfer technology to Japan. And you've seen a progression. You know, back in the 80s and 90s, Japan was making fuselage parts and other tail parts and so forth. And I remember in the 80s, early 90s, I was dealing with Boeing a lot at that time and expressed concern about the outsourcing of so much of the plane to Japan. And the Boeing executives at the time said to me, look, Clyde, they said there are two key parts of the plane. That's the wings and the cockpit. And they said, we will never outsource the wings and the cockpit. Well, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner's wings are being made in Japan. So there's a, you know, kind of a constant progression here. And you do wonder, where is this going to wind up?
Jim Sterngold, I mean, you mentioned earlier this idea that the rules are different, the cultures are different. When you read about the transfer of U.S. technology, whether it be for the 787 Dreamliner or whether you read about it, I know that there is a story in this week's edition of Bloomberg Business Week about Lexus, the luxury division of Toyota, sending Chinese representatives to United States showrooms of Lexus so that they can learn how to offer that same level of Lexus service in China, even though the automobiles, they're made in Japan, shipped to China, huge duties, huge tariffs. That makes it difficult for them to compete. All the Lexus automobiles in the United States, made in Japan, shipped here. That doesn't sound as if there is an understanding that both sides need to win a little bit.
Well, you know, the U.S. was generous with Japan and many other states in Asia because of strategic reasons. We believe that that created a bulwark against Soviet influence and communist influence from China during the Cold War. So we felt it was okay to give up something because what we were getting was a form of security that made it worth our while. There's always a reason that we feel we're getting some benefit out of the deal. Now it's not the U.S. government so much as the companies that feel like, okay, we're going to give away some technology to China, but we're getting access to this market of a billion plus people. And so net-net, we're going to come out ahead. First of all, you do have to give something up to build a long-term presence in these markets. That, without a doubt, is true. But also, it's a dynamic process. I mean, there is no right answer today that's going to be right tomorrow. You're playing against a moving target. It is an immensely difficult strategic challenge for these companies to figure that out. You've got to give to get, but many of these states play us like a fiddle.
Play us like a fiddle, indeed. All right, I want to thank you very much, Jim Sterngold from Bloomberg News, and Clyde Prestowitz. He is the president of Economic Strategy Institute, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Commerce.
You can subscribe to Bloomberg's premium podcast service at Bloomberg.com/Tom Keene and listen to Taking Stock weekday afternoons at 3 Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on satellite radio, Sirius Channel 130 and XM Channel 129. Copyright 2011, Bloomberg LP.